Well, ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to welcome you to the Central RAC meeting tonight. We have some special visitors tonight. We have Director Sheehan with us, who is the Division Director. We appreciate him being here. We also have Board Member Calvin Crandall. And then we have Chris Kelleher, who is the Deputy Director of Species Recovery, and he's presenting our prairie dog stuff tonight. My name's Gary Nelson. I'm the Central RAC Chairman. We'll start over here and have the RAC members identify themselves.
Tim Fair and Large.
Jacob Steele, Kosher Tribe.
Carl Hurst, Sportsman.
Greg McPhee, Wasatch County.
Larry Fitzgerald, Agriculture.
Richard Hanson, At Large.
Chris Marvel, At Large.
Dan Potts, non-consumptive.
RAC member replacing Jim Tuck.
Matt Clark, Sportsman.
Christine Schmitz, non-consumptive.
Thank you. We'd like to recognize Greg McPhee. He's replacing Jay Price, his elected official, and he'll be a member of the Central RAC. A couple of things. Before we get going, I need to entertain a motion. You've had a chance to look at the agenda and the minutes for this meeting. Is there any corrections or additions that need to be made that you're aware of? Okay, I'll entertain a motion to accept.
So moved.
Motion made by Tim, seconded by Carl. All in favor? Okay, motion passes unanimously. All right, board meeting update. We had four items that we decided on, deliberated on last RAC meeting. We had the private fish pond rule, and as it went through the wildlife board process, it passed. Unanimously. We also had the black bear recommendations. There was fairly lengthy discussions there, like there was at our RAC meeting, and with some minor adjustments, most of that passed as well. It's written in detail, and it's available if you're curious and you'd like to look at it. The third item that we dealt with was the wolf management plan extension. Numerous years ago, when it appeared wolves were cruising our way, they proposed a plan to manage them once they get here. And this was just an extension to that same management plan, and that passed unanimously. The last thing that was dealt with at the board meeting was the convention permit rule. And that's that's the timely stuff that goes along with the expo. Quite a bit of discussion on that as well, about the fees and how much money, and similar to how it went with our RAC, that passed unanimously as well. Now we'll listen to John Fairchild. He's a Central Region Supervisor, and he'll give us our regional update.
You know, I'm going to wing this one because I've had a lot going, and I this RAC meeting took a lot of us by surprise. So I'm going to let's see. We've got in our wildlife section, we've got a really good effort going on in Wasatch County right now, dealing with our revision of our elk management plan for the Wasatch unit that has had a lot of concern generated from sportsmen and landowners and CWMU operators and developers, and just anyone has a vested interest in the future of elk management on that unit. It takes in three subunits: the Abinaquin, the Kern Creek, and the Wasatch West. We met last week. We kind of identified some goals and objectives, and this next week we're going to talk through, and we identified some issues and concerns. And then this next week we're going to be meeting again to talk about some strategies for antlerless harvest, also see if we can come to a consensus on whether or not to change the population objective for that entire unit. In our aquatics, we've got an effort going on with Utah Lake to get a better understanding on Northern Pike, the impact that they're having on the fishery there, and we're actually catching pike and doing diet studies with Utah State University, that's become a big issue. Another issue in our aquatic section is the quagga mussel suspected status there in Deer Creek Reservoir. We have Alan Ward representing our region on a committee that's putting together a plan to address, management of boats in and out of Deer Creek Reservoir, and that's going to be a huge effort to try to, it's mainly an outreach effort to get people to understand the severity of what we're dealing with and the likelihood that if they are present, we're not 100% sure that we have quad muscle. We know we have the very young juvenile stage, the Belliger that really is not able to reproduce. And that's why it's classified as suspected. We just need their support in taking care of their boats and clean, drain, and dry, and observing the rules that we're going to have in place for that. Anything else, Mike, you want pitched for aquatics?
Yeah, I mentioned Jordan L Reservoir. We're really interested in the management of that reservoir. We're going to be incorporating a lot of public input on what to do at that reservoir. There will be an online survey going out within the next day or two. That'll be located on DWR's website, Facebook pages, and we're really going to try and encourage the public to provide some information to us as biologists as far as what they want to see at Jordan L Reservoir, just trying to improve the opportunities there for anglers. And then we'll have, a public working group that will get together and try and make some decisions and update the management plan there at that reservoir. So that's kind of a big project in aquatics right now.
Yep. Thanks. In our habitat section, we've completed a draft of a management plan, habitat management plan for the North Sandpete Wildlife Management Areas. There are about 4,000 acres involved. And we presented that to the Sandpete County Public Lands Committee last night. And it will eventually come to this rack for review. It also goes out through the Resource Development Coordinating Council, the statewide clearinghouse for all state activities. So the counties will get another shot at it. Basically identifies how those lands will be managed with emphasis on access and managing access so that those areas are protected during the winter from too much disturbance by people and vehicles. Our outreach, Scott, you're on. Scott left. Let's see. Yeah, Mark, go for it.
We got grazing bids that are out right now.
Ah, there you go.
For about four properties that we're renewing or putting back out for bid. So livestock grazing. Those properties can be found on our website and on the division website. Type in grazing on the search window and it'll bring up the link. So anybody that knows bid that's interested in that, it's available there. I think our Friday end of business is our deadline for bids.
Good. One thing that, as a region, that we're very involved with right now is coming up with our work plans. That's a process that is fairly involved. We're trying to get a better connection between what we do and what are the highest priorities within the division, and build in a lot of accountability for that. Scott, we got any outreach items that you wanted to pitch tonight? We got dedicated hunter program. People are starting to look for projects.
Yep.
We need to have them get a hold of Derek and
my big pitch is a lot of the dedicated hunters that first year they didn't have to do any service hours, so we're going to have a grundle for good projects. So we're all ears. If you have a good conservation project, talk to Derek Murdoch. And we got a lot of things going on, but that's a good one we can talk about. And getting ready for the day-old chick program coming up here in the next few months, so there's another good one. Community fishing ponds, I guess Mike probably talked about getting ready to stock those here in the near future, but A lot's going on.
Starting this week, actually. We're starting to stock those right now.
Good.
Okay, that's about it.
If you have any questions, we'll be...
Any?
Good.
Did you address law enforcement? Any poaching?
Not sure that we've got anything new there. There's always cases that our guys are following up on. We're going to have some... we're going to have a meeting here. The section is getting together here in a couple weeks, and there's going to be a lot of training. I'm going to participate and sit in on those. I always learn a lot when I go, and they hold those down in St. George. So all of our officers will be attending that. You know, of course there'll be coverage. Scott Rood will be taking care of law enforcement in the Central Region while they're gone. So other than that, we give him one bullet. You know.
John, is there, I don't know what you can say, or if you can, or if you know anything about the Wolf Down South, how that is progressing or what's happening there.
I mean that case is ongoing. I think it's in the hands of the Fish and Wildlife Service, correct? And as you know, it was identified to be the same wolf that was seen on the north rim of the Grand Canyon. So.
Yes. You know what the Fish and Wildlife is doing with that? Or they, you say it's ongoing as, okay, we know what it was, we're going to put the guy in jail, we're going to string him up, we're going to turn him loose?
Do you know
what they're doing with that? I mean, I've heard rumors, but...
I don't know what that...
They've met with a lot of the folks involved, interviewed them, working that case, but they don't move maybe as quick at the federal level sometimes on these prosecutions, or really? Lack of prosecution as we do. So it could be a few more months before
anything is decided, whether they're going to prosecute or whether they're going to be whatever. Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you, John. For those of you who have attended these meetings before, we kind of have a procedure that we go through. Typically, we'll have a presentation by the division about whatever it is we're going to talk about or decide or vote on tonight. After the presentation, we'll ask the RAC if they have any questions about the presentation. We'll then open it up to the audience to ask any questions they may have about the presentation, at which time we'll close the question period and we'll open up to a comment period. For those of you who have come in, there are some yellow cards right there as you come in, right by the agendas, if you wish to comment on anything that's going on here tonight. If you fill out a comment card and put which agenda item you're wishing to comment on, when we get to that point in time, I'll call you from the audience and have you speak to the group. As we've said a lot of different times, most of us feel really strongly about wildlife. It's why we're here. And so we need to respect each other's opinions and give each other a chance to speak. But we appreciate you being here, both the division personnel and everybody else. Are you ready? Our first presentation will be by Chris Kelleher. He's the Deputy Director of the Species Recovery, and he's our first action item, and it's the Utah Prairie Dog Management Plan.
Hi, everybody. I actually work for the Department of Natural Resources, but I've paid my dues at the Division of Wildlife, and I've put a lot of time in on this prairie dog issue. So this presentation's occurring at all the RACs tonight, and I got Shanghai to present here. So bear with me and we'll get through this. Just to summarize the presentation, there's a recent court finding that led to the development of this plan, and I'll share a little information on that. And then I'll give a little background info on Utah Prairie Dog and their management history. Then I'll cover the draft plan that we're talking about for managing prairie dogs on non-federal lands, and summarize a rule change that accompanies that plan. Okay. So let me find my buttons here. Recently, in November of 2014, there was a court finding in PEPPO versus U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And PEPPO is an acronym for a group that formed down in the Cedar City area, and it stands for People for the Ethical Treatment of Property Owners.
Sorry, that's great.
These folks were fed up with having to deal with a federally listed species on their private lands and having to deal with it. The judge found in their favor, and by doing so, that turned the management authority for that species away from the Fish and Wildlife Service and back to the Division of Wildlife. When a species is listed, all unlisted species are managed by the Division of Wildlife, but once a species is listed, then the Fish and Wildlife Service, the federal government, takes over their management. But with this finding, and it caught a lot of people unexpected, the management authority for Utah prairie dogs on non-federal lands was turned over to the Division of Wildlife. Commerce Clause, which is the clause under which the Endangered Species Act was enacted, does not apply to Utah prairie dogs based on this finding. So Division of Wildlife takes over management authority, but Utah prairie dogs on federal land still are managed under the Endangered Species Act by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So that's a summary of the court finding. So by way of background, Utah prairie dog is one of five species of prairie dogs in North America, and it exists only in southwestern Utah. So if we take a look at this map here, this is just a distribution of the five species. We've got Mexican prairie dog in the green down in the south, black-tailed prairie dog, that blue blob in the middle of the country there, Gunnison prairie dog, white-tailed prairie dog in the red there, and then Utah prairie dog, only within the state of Utah. And because it's only in one state and had no commercial value, that's why the Commerce Clause was found not to apply to the species. So Utah prairie dog were listed as endangered in 1973 because they had very reduced numbers and their range had been reduced very low. When it was listed, there were about 3,000 individuals remaining, they estimate. This here is just a map showing the historic distribution of Utah prairie dogs. And you did used to have them in the central region here, John, way back when, but they aren't there anymore.
Down by Gunnison.
But the blue blobs represent the current distribution, 2014. But those are buffered colonies, so they really aren't all in that area there. It's just buffered to protect landowners and that sort of thing. Utah prairie dog were downlisted from endangered to threatened in 1984, and what that allowed for was with a threatened species, there are some regulations under the Endangered Species Act that allow individuals to take those prairie dogs where they're causing problems. About 70% of Utah prairie dogs are on non-federal unprotected lands. And the thing with Utah prairie dogs is in order for those animals to count towards recovery, the Fish and Wildlife Service has determined that the land where they occur, the habitat needs to be protected, either federal land or some agreement that protects that habitat for prairie dogs. So any prairie dogs that are on unprotected lands don't count towards recovery. So these 16,000 adults here don't even count towards recovery under the Endangered Species they're under the recovery plan. They prefer sage step habitat and eat grass and forbs. They have one litter a year, and the average litter size is about four, a little over four pups. So in terms of the management history, each spring the Division of Wildlife and some of our partners go out and count prairie dogs. This has been happening since the early 1970s. We also do translocations, take prairie dogs from areas where they're causing conflicts and move them out onto protected lands or onto federal lands. And then also manage the permitting process. The Division of Wildlife has managed a lot of the permitting process in the past. There's a number of habitat conservation plans range-wide, and these habitat conservation plans are a mechanism under the Endangered Species Act that allows for prairie dogs to be taken in areas that are going to be developed. But there's mitigation requirements associated with those. The Utah Prairie Dog Recovery Plan, every listed species is service puts together a recovery plan for them. And the goals of the recovery plan are 1,000 counted adults on public or protected land in each of three recovery units. There's three recovery units within the range of Utah prairie dogs. And in addition to that, the recovery plan calls for 5,000 protected occupied acres of habitat in each of those three recovery units. So that's how things have happened in the past. Now we're moving into the draft plan that the Division of Wildlife has put together. We can't get into this without acknowledging a lot of participation and collaboration with a number of parties that helped develop this plan. And they're all listed there. I won't bother to read them, but they've all contributed and worked very hard to with the division to try and make this a workable plan. The goal of the plan is to remove restrictions from private property through a timely and structured process while assisting in the conservation of populations on designated federal and protected non-federal lands. So in terms of overarching objectives, the first one of the management objectives is to develop a cooperative education and information mechanism. The counties and the Division of Wildlife are going to work together to put together an online education and also online permitting process for people that want to be involved and want to be allowed to take dogs off their land. The DWR will also coordinate a series of outreach campaigns in the spring of 2015, promoting the value of prairie dogs on protected lands as their importance for recovery, with the ultimate goal to recover the species so that we don't have to deal with the Endangered Species Act anymore. And then also to lay out the plan and how things have changed since under this new process. Another objective is to remove restrictions on all non-federal lands that are not occupied by Utah prairie dogs. And what the division is proposing is that any properties that are not mapped as Utah prairie dog habitat as of 2014 are exempt. There's no restrictions on those lands. And mapped habitat for Utah prairie dog since the division has started counting prairie dogs, their distribution has been mapped and as they move across the landscape, the map doesn't change, it only grows. There's a lot of properties that are mapped habitat that no longer have prairie dogs on them. Also, properties with mapped habitat that is unoccupied are exempt. And then DWR maintains that database of mapped and occupied properties. If the city has somebody who wants to develop a property, they can go to the Division of Wildlife and access that database to see if it's occupied and if they need to go through the process of getting permitted to take those prairie dogs. And this map is just an example of how things change under the state plan. On the left, the green is under the Habitat Conservation Plan for Iron County. Those areas where surveys for prairie dogs would need to occur if anybody was going to do a development or any sort of project on the land. On the right, what the division has done here is taken out all those lands that aren't occupied but are a mapped habitat. And what this does is it removes that requirement for surveys from about 51,000 acres of land. So it eases up things considerably, and this is without impacting any prairie dogs at all. It's just taking a look at it from the angle of protecting those private property owners first. Another objective is to remove prairie dogs from health, safety, and welfare concern areas. And these areas, I gotta get my notes, they don't come up on my computer here. These are public use areas like parks and golf courses, and also residential areas. Any place where a prairie dog might cause concerns with health, safety, and welfare. Those prairie dogs can be removed without a permit, but the DWR needs to be notified prior to that, and then the number of prairie dogs that are taken need to be reported to the division. Once the division is notified, if there's an opportunity, the preference is to go in and trap those dogs and move them off properties where they're causing a conflict, and then introduce them into protected or federal lands where they can be used and counted towards recovery. We'll focus on trapping prior to any lethal take of those prairie dogs. There's an annual take allotment under the management plan of 6,000 Utah prairie dogs range wide. This number is the same number that was used under what's called the 4D rule, Section 4 of the Endangered Species Act, that allowed for take of prairie dogs on federal land or on agricultural lands. This number was originally set as part of that permitting process and carries over into this plan. There'll be an additional take. It'll be ratcheted if we're doing really well with recovery. Additional take will be allowed on non-federal lands. Utah prairie dogs that are taken for health, safety, and welfare that I talked about in the previous slide will not be deducted from this take amount. And if the prairie dogs are trapped and relocated, they won't be deducted from that amount either. So the range-wide take limit will be applied to three types of land: developable land, agricultural, and range lands. And we'll cover developable land first. And developable is, we couldn't even find it in the dictionary. We don't know if it's a real word or not. But it's defined as areas zoned as commercial, industrial, or residential that have no structures or improvements on them other than utilities. So prior to any ground disturbance within mapped habitat, the Division of Wildlife be contacted to perform an occupancy survey, see if any prairie dogs are there. If there aren't any prairie dogs, the division will provide a letter of approval to proceed with the project. If prairie dogs are found, the project proponent will get a permit from the division to take the Utah prairie dogs to allow the project to proceed. Take will be deducted from the annual take allotment unless there's time to get in there and trap them prior to the project. And if we get them trapped and relocated, then they won't be deducted from that $6,000. And then also any undeveloped lots with Utah prairie dogs that are moving on to them from adjacent lots can be trapped. It's part of that. The big thing here is there's no mitigation fees associated with that. Under the Federal Endangered Species Act and the Habitat Conservation Plans, there were mitigation fees associated with those of about $1,000 per acre. Okay, now we're on to agriculture and rangelands. And ag land is defined as any as land zoned for agriculture that's used for crop production or irrigated pasture or has been used for crop production in the past 5 years. And the goal, the objective is to alleviate the impacts to agriculture and rangelands. Permit may be issued for the lethal removal of Utah prairie dog. Authorized take will be deducted from that $6,000 unless if we can get in there and trap them prior to that, and then that will not be deducted. And lethal take allotments per permit will be calculated as follows on this next slide. So on the left column here, we've got count of Utah prairie dogs, and that's the count on protected lands. So that's the number of prairie dogs that will count towards recovery of the species to get them off the federal endangered species list. And if you remember that number is 1,000, the goal in the recovery plan. We've scaled it up here to add further protection for those prairie dogs. But if the count is less than or 0 to 999, 50% of productivity is allowed to be taken, and then you can see how it changes as we scale up in numbers. And there's a calculation there on the bottom for productivity, and I'll read through that briefly here. Productivity is equal to the spring count. That's the number of prairie dogs that are seen when the division goes out to do their annual census. And you multiply that by 2, because at any one time, the understanding is that there's half prairie dogs underground. So you get a spring count, you multiply that by 2. About 2/3 of the prairie dogs at any one time are female. So you multiply that by 6.67. And then about 97% of the females in any given year breed. So you multiply that by 0.97, and then you've got an average litter size each year of 4. So you multiply by 4. And that gets you your productivity estimate. So a short way of doing that is you take the count and multiply it by 7.2. We can talk through that if anybody needs to. But here's an example. If you have a spring count of 75 on somebody's ag land, the equation to calculate how many prairie dogs they can take off that land in a given year, you run it through that equation that we just talked about. And then depending on, back up here, we do that in step one. Then step two, we got to refer to that table. And if the 3-year average on protected lands is 626. Pop back here. It puts it into that first category up there. So we're only allowed 50% take of the productivity. Productivity is 390 based on step one, working through that calculation. So the ag user there is allowed to take 195 prairie dogs that year. It's complicated, but there's been a lot of research on prairie dogs, and the biologists really understand what's going on out there. Another component of this plan that we haven't had in the past is a voluntary incentive program for agricultural lands. And this is any agricultural lands with more than 50 prairie dogs in the spring count are eligible to enroll in this. But the landowner has to forego lethal take to allow the division to trap and relocate those prairie dogs for recovery purposes from July through September, whenever they can schedule it in. The participant will receive compensation for the damages to their agricultural crop. And then they can get a lethal take once trapping's completed to take the rest of the prairie dogs. Compensation is based on the number of adult Utah prairie dogs in the spring count, and one adult Utah prairie dog is equal to $45.90 of seasonal damage. And that was worked out with the ag users down there. The division met with them, and they had some data on how much food prairie dogs eat, and that's based on alfalfa. And in addition to that compensation, there will be an additional 10% added to that to compensate for any damaged equipment from riding through burrows and that sort of thing. So now we move into the state's, the portion of the plan that talks about recovery or federal and protected lands. And the division's been working with partners down there for years and years and years on this effort, and have been making a lot of headway lately. So the objective here is to retain state management on the non-federal lands, and then continue to help those partners with conservation measures on federal lands. And there's a number of things that we do in terms of conservation actions, work with a recovery implementation team down there and local governments, cooperate with the federal agencies, BLM, Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife Service. We're working to establish a state funding mechanism for the management, acquire and protect habitats, monitor translocation sites, do a lot of translocations, manage disease. Plague is a big issue with prairie dogs. We've had a lot of success in abating plague using a deltramethrin dust to manage the fleas that are the vector for the plague. We're also working on a vaccine, an oral vaccine now that we're hopeful, have a lot of hope in. And we also do a lot of research efforts or get involved in a lot. Also, the goal is to protect what we have on federal lands and also increase their crop populations so that we can achieve those recovery targets. Work to develop translocation sites, and you just can't dump the prairie dogs out there on federal land. We actually build artificial burrows for them so they can shelter from predators and that sort of thing, just to get established, and then they start digging their own burrows. And we've had a lot of success in these translocation efforts lately. So we'll continue to work on supporting recovery objectives that are consistent with the state plan, and then also develop a multi-year translocation plan. So that's pretty much the summary of what's in the plan itself. Because of the regulatory change associated with this court finding, We need to make some changes to the rules associated with prairie dogs. So here's some of the key provisions associated with that. Utah prairie dogs still cannot be taken on federal land except when authorized by the Fish and Wildlife Service. They're still in charge there. Utah prairie dogs can be taken when found in inhabited structures. Every year it seems like we find prairie dogs moving into somebody's home or something for whatever reason. I don't understand it. But they can be taken. A permit may be issued to the city or county law enforcement agencies to authorize take Utah prairie dogs threatening public health, safety, and welfare. Utah prairie dogs may only be taken by a landowner, a lessee, an immediate family member, employee on regular payroll, or approved designee. Utah prairie dogs can be lethally removed using any means permitted by a state, local, or federal law. A person may not capture or attempt to capture a prairie dog live, possess a live prairie dog, or release a live prairie dog into the wild. Utah prairie dogs cannot be taken on protected land. Utah prairie dog regulations will be removed from the old rule. And Utah prairie dog classification will be changed from prohibited to controlled for lethal take. And that sums it up. Hope that was concise enough. And, if there are any questions, I can try to answer them. All
right. Questions from the rack. Go ahead, Danny.
Yeah, I looked over the plan. I liked it, but I couldn't find any mention of predators or anything like that. So how does, you know, what other natural predators, historic predators? Just talk a bit about that.
Predators on prairie dog?
Right.
Badgers are a big one. Coyotes, you know, the typical desert predators out there, and oftentimes with translocation site, there'll be some predator control efforts associated with it to allow the prairie dogs to get a foothold.
Right. And then, so, because so for instance, I know that people will wonder, you know, there's always an association between prairie dogs and ferrets, for instance. Is there any relationship historically or anything like that with these?
Not that I'm aware of. Okay. I don't think ferrets were that far south.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
You talk a lot about federal lands and private ownership. Is there any state lands involved in the recovery units?
There are SITLA lands down there, and they fall under this plan.
Everything not federal is here, so Division of Wildlife, School Trust lands, city, county, other state lands, anything that's...
Those are your non-federal protected lands?
They're only protected if they have some protection mechanism as part of it, like conservation easement.
You got federal, non-federal, protected, not protected, and then you're private.
Private falls into the non-federal.
It'd fall into the non-federal.
Yeah.
So on the protected lands, maybe I didn't understand this in the plan, but on the protected lands, it's essentially prohibited to take prairie dogs in any way. Is that essentially what the plan calls for?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So with the new obligation for the division, did any funds flow with that obligation? Funds from the state? Funds from agriculture?
That remains to be seen. Senator Vickers has a bill up in the Capitol right now. I don't know if you have any.
He's asked for $650,000 that would be for us to administer this plan, part of it, and part of it to pay for crop damage on agricultural rounds. If it's funded, so we're, it's funded. We'll know in the next week.
Otherwise, sure. You have an unfunded obligation, right?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Chris.
Sorry, one other question. You mentioned translocation. Are those going to be translocated to federal lands?
Yeah, that federal or protected lands. There have been some lands that have been acquired by fee title purchased, or lands that have conservation easements on them. And those are options, but primarily it's federal lands that they're transferred to.
And the population counts, are they... There was a federal land objective, right, to say, got at least 1,000 within a recovery unit.
Mm-hmm.
Do the population counts? So if you translocate them, this is what I'm thinking. So if you translocate them to federal lands, you're going to increase your population.
Mm-hmm.
If you translocate them to protected lands, does that go towards the population count?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah, Chris, I just have a question. Is there a likelihood, or is there something the state could do that would trigger a stay on the case, or and also it's an appeal? The service is appealed this. What would happen, you know, in the future? If even with the stay, would this go back to the original management plan? What would happen to this
point? I'm really not the person to comment on the legal aspects of this. Yeah. Oh, Mark, sorry.
So here's kind of the background. If in November 4th, the federal judge made his ruling, and by the end of December, the Fish and Wildlife Service had appealed this, and a group called Friends of Animals had appealed this. That will take, as long as the court wants, probably a year and a half or so to be heard. If it's conceivable that somebody could petition a stay once this plan is done and ask the court to stop what the state's approved here, and a judge will have to decide if this is so outlandish in their mind or so dangerous to the prairie dogs that that we can't do anything. And at that point, I think it would kick it back into full federal protections that we're operating under before November
4th. So state activity probably wouldn't, there's not a risk that that would shatter triggers pay to something better than that.
Anybody can petition for a stay if they don't like what we're doing. So there's nothing automatic. It would take some federal agency or private organization to petition for the court for a stay and say, stop this, we don't like it. And the court may or may not adhere to that. We would have to go to probably San Francisco, the federal court, and explain why we think this plan still provides adequate protections until the appeal can be heard in the appeals courts.
So Senator Vickers, I guess the state would affect that prospective funding, but...
No,
I mean,
but
you could probably relinquish that kind of funding pretty quick. I mean, 600,000 is for how long? How long is that?
If he gets it, it'd be one-time funding.
One-time funding.
And so that will happen whether or not anything happens or not. But if we ultimately couldn't use it, I guess the legislature would want the money back.
Well, that money probably isn't connected to this plan yet. So it needs to be used.
It's connected to this. Okay. That's what the premise of asking for money was.
Any more questions from the rack? Any more questions from the audience? Would you state your name, please?
Mark Fulmer.
Did you get that?
Mark Fulmer.
Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Yeah, I did have one question. Taken.
Mark.
You referred numerous times that they can be taken. Live traps for relocation, poison grain, you're gonna kill them and then take them, or you're gonna shoot them? Explain,
there's,
take them.
The Division of Wildlife can take the live dogs, trap them. Yeah.
Okay.
The other legal mechanisms are shoot.
Okay.
or kill traps.
Okay.
As I understand
and that's,
the gravel flow.
And that's with a permit. You're permitted to do that. I can't just go out with a bunch of friends and say, hey, you know what, let's go take our 22s and go shoot some dogs.
No,
that would be against the law.
You're supposed to contact the division first.
You get approval. You can
go. If I get approval,
you can't buy any 22 bullets anyway.
I know a guy who knows a guy. I've done that one in my younger days with an op-6, and it's...
That's a good question. Though. Do you have to have a small game permit? You have to fall under the safety.
The COR permit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And you have to be associated with the land. If it's private land, you have to be a landowner. Mm-hmm. Family issues that way. I mean, if it's on state land, you're not going to get that permit. Because more than likely, if it's on state land and there's dogs, there's going to be it's going to be a protected area.
Under the states.
And be under the state's jurisdiction. Yeah. Okay.
Well, until they're down, until they're not listed anymore, it's threatened.
Right.
Okay. You know, maybe just the general, sorry, Mr. Chair. Just a general theme to add here. We're very interested in keeping state management authority over the species. It's been 41 years since the state, 42 years, had authority over prairie dogs. We're trying to help alleviate problems with private property owners, with agriculture, with homeowners, with commercial, but still protect the species. We want them, to have a good foundation down there. And we really think this plan has a lot of elements that can alleviate some of the conflicts that have been created over the last 42 years. And at the same time, create assurances that the prairie dogs are going to be able to move forward. And we need that because we know we'll be in court at some point talking about this very thing. So we're trying to do a well-balanced plan, and we've had a lot of stakeholders involved.
I guess the other option is then it goes back to federal control. The ESA takes over and it's under federal control and it's hands off. If you've got 5 acres you want to develop, good luck. Yeah. If you got 5 acres of ag land and they eat the hay off every year, sucks to be you. That's pretty much the way it is under the federal guidelines, isn't
there's,
it?
There's mechanisms there. There's the HCPs for development projects, and then there's the 4D rule for ag take. But they're cumbersome and they're expensive.
Yeah,
and,
it's
this is a lot more user-friendly.
User-friendly.
Yeah.
This looks like a well-crafted enough plan, though, that if somebody does try and throw a stay, that they could look at the plan and say, this is a responsible management plan. Right? The state's not recognized.
For
yeah.
The private land, the protected land, and for the animals themselves to keep them going.
Audience.
One other case, I'm not sure which circuit court went through, but there's one other case that we were opposite on the Commerce Clause of the U.S. And so... That will go probably to Supreme Court. However, this is ruled this appeal, and this will be a strong appeal because I think the Fish and Wildlife Service is up to losing about 60% of the species manageable. So it's going to be a strong appeal.
This case wouldn't go and take it to the Supreme Court, but if the Federal Appeals Court ruled in favor of this judge, you'd have a split decision. There's actually 4 courts that have ruled against this type of thing. At this point, 1 that has, and who knows if it goes from there. I think that the lawyers might be interested.
Any other questions from the audience? Okay. Well, I'll open the comment period. I only have 1 comment card, and it's an unusual situation. We as RAC members represent our constituents in our areas, and we have Christine Schmitz who will be representing a comment from the public. Go ahead, Christine.
Okay, so I received this letter which says, the Humane Society of the United States Prairie Dog Coalition is a national organization with associated Utah members. Wildlife Earth Guardians is a national organization with 137 Utah members. Defenders of Wildlife is a national organization with 8,700 Utah members and supporters. On behalf of these organizations and their Utah members, we would like you to make the following comments to the Utah Prairie Dog Management Plan, known as the Central Area RAC, in its meeting on March 3, 2015, which was issued on February 25, 2015. One, we suggest the state of Utah continue protection efforts on private land in alignment with federal standards developed under the 4D rule. This plan should conform to that rule. Utah prairie dogs are still currently protected under the ESA, regardless of the ability of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to regulate take on private lands. This management plan should reflect the continued progress to achievement of recovery goals. Excessive take allowances will limit or defeat the progress towards delisting. And to that end, we urge the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources to maintain the take limits as prescribed under the 4D rule. Thank you for the opportunity to comment. Sincerely, Gia Zawala, Program Manager, the Humane Society of the United States Prairie Dog Coalition, Steve Forrest, Senior Representative, Defenders of Wildlife, and Taylor Jones, Endangered Species Advocate, Wild Earth Guardians.
Thank you, Christine. Are there any other comments?
Can we get a copy of that? I can get an extra one. I can go make a copy.
I have no more comment cards from the audience. Is there any other comments? How different is this than the 4D?
Yeah, that was my
question. The 4D had the 6,000 take limit. That's where it came from.
Okay.
It
was the 4D. All right.
So it's the same.
There are elements of it that are the same, but not entirely. The 4D addressed agricultural lands. 4D didn't address take of a prairie dog that's run around somebody's basement, okay, in their house. The 4D was a structured program that said, you know, we can accept a certain amount of take each year to address some of these agricultural issues, but many lands were never a part of that. You know, potential housing subdivisions. Am I getting that right,
yeah,
Chris?
Yeah.
So it's hard to just say it's the 4D. That is certainly a part of it, and I think it's a part of this.
Go ahead, Chris.
I agree the plan seems well written. You've got great triggers in there, and I think you've got to protect the landowners. And so based on that, I move to accept the division's plan is presented.
Okay, is that a motion?
Yes.
I'll second it.
Okay, seconded by Richard. All in favor? Okay, 7-4 opposed. Okay, 7-4, 1 opposed. Motion passes. Are you also going to do the what?
And 1 abstention.
Oh. Yes, thank you. Thank you. We also have a presentation on taking of, this is the last one, right? You're ready to do it?
That's part of it. It's already done.
That was it.
It's rolled in. It's
just the roll.
I was getting ready to make an aardvark comment and stuff, but. We read through the list. For those of you who came for the regular part of the meeting, that's the regular part of the meeting. We have one item, right?
Well, there are two action items, but it was one presentation.
Okay.
So you got to take action on the rule. You took action on the plan.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. And now we're going. All right. We'll now entertain. The next part of this is an action item as well, and it's the taking of prairie dogs.
I'll make a motion that we accept the rule of taking Utah prairie dogs as presented.
Okay, motion made by Matt.
Second.
Seconded by Tim.
Is that going to be called out by the 657-70?
It is. That's the rule. So to restate that, 657-70, taking a prairie dog, and you restate your motion, please.
Yeah, I make a motion that we accept the rule 657-70, taking of the Utah prairie dog as presented.
Okay, and it was seconded by Tim.
Still seconded.
All in favor? Eight in favor, all opposed? One opposed? Motion passes.
Yeah.
All right.
I don't know if we need to set up any differently, but we got a question and answer period involving our regional program managers or their designated representatives. Mr. Becker
here.
And all of them are prepared to prime the pump a little bit. If you don't have questions or topics that you would like to discuss, Tom and Mark and who else we got? Mike? Why don't you start us off? Just because if you don't, we're going to have 15 different conversations get going here.
I just wrote down a few things, what's coming up every day.
I'm sorry, but we've got too much going on.
thank you.
Let me know.
Just a few things. That we've been actively, as a lot of you know, been capturing deer and elk and putting GPS collars on for some of the studies we're working on. So that's been taking place all winter, and we're about to start a recapture of some of the deer that we captured earlier in February, just to see body condition changes and those kinds of things. The moose study's got, I believe, another season left to go through summer with the student, and then we'll be seeing what happens with those collars, how we follow up on the life expectancy and the life span of the collars. Whether it's a student coming off and flying and locating, or we're going to pick that up and keep track of those. Sage?
On moose, they're showing a little bit of difference on the Uinta versus the Wasatch mortality, but it's not as different as they thought it would be. Is that
honestly, I'm not as up to it as probably Dale is, but Dale, have you been up today?
Yeah, there's not much difference.
Don't you hate this pillar?
The moss spot has a little bit
when
higher.
When we redid the building?
A little bit higher reproductive rate than the Wasatch does.
Okay, and coming up, sage grouse let counts. We'll be doing those starting probably next month through April and into May a little bit. Guzzler projects, we've got a few guzzlers that we're working on, mostly on the Stansbury and West Desert with the BLM. Kind of like a follow through with the fires that we've had. Some of those got burned up. We've replaced some of the tanks with boss tanks. Now we're going to add aprons onto those to enhance the catch of the rainfall and snow. Range rides this spring will be coming up. We don't have any dates on those, but those are something we're starting to do every year. Bear denning is starting probably the end of the week. We don't have firm dates on anything after probably Friday, but it's on a evaluation with the weather and with everything else going on with recommendations fitting it in. But, so if you want to get on something like that, Dale or Dennis are the ones doing those, since I don't have any bears. Other than that, recommendations are just about
in. I've been hearing a lot of people that have been seeing more sage-grouse. I mean, am I just running into folks that are in the right areas, or how's our population?
Well, they're moving around a lot right now because they're kind of coming in from the winter range back up to the strutting grounds, so they are on the move. That might be a factor of it. I'm not seeing that out in the West Desert yet, but I'm hoping we have one. We were mowed last year on the West Desert, so we could sure use a good productive year. With the weather the way it's been all winter, we probably had some pretty good winter survival, but it's bringing the chicks off and raising them to the adults that really matter. But other than that, I started it off.
Yes, you did. But and you hit on a variety of topics that maybe they want to follow up with some questions on. Oh, so, yeah, you don't get to sit down.
Any questions?
I'm going to help prime the pump a little bit. On the the doe and fawn mortality study, you know, our the collaring study that we've got going. During these mild winters, give an idea of how survival has differed from, you know, from previous years or.
Well, I can't use the collar study totally, but now in my area, I usually lose 20% on a good normal winter. Mm-hmm. That's desert stuff. This year, we initially had a hard time finding deer because when we went to capture them, they were up at 8,000 feet, and they've been there all winter long, and they're still there. That tells me we're going to probably have the best survival we can have, with the weather conditions. That's possible. We still will probably be looking at 70s, low 80s for survival rates. On a bad winter, I would expect that to go down to the 60s, 50s kind of thing. So, big difference. The color stuff that we did with the GPS just recently, I've already had 8 mortalities, and that's out of the 12 on the statewide. I've had 8 of them. So that could be my 20% that I normally would see on any given year.
Yeah, what was the cause?
I had 3 cougar, 3 coyote, 1 train, and 1 polycatcher related. So it's, and there's one that's acting like it's dead, but I don't know what it is yet. We'll have to go check it out. For some reason, I'm getting the majority of them.
Sorry, I may have missed this. When you say high 70, low 80 survival, is that fawns, does?
That's usually both, fawns and does. On a bad winter, you usually would expect to see fewer fawns survive. But does would be not too far off.
Is that this year mostly weather related, because we had such a open fall, we didn't have much snow, that's why they stayed up higher?
Yeah. They haven't even started using winter range.
Is it too early to say that this coyote
it's too early.
It's too early to say if that's had an effect on it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I thought I read something from the DWR. Like the winter of 13-14, you had 83% survival rate, fawns. I read that.
13-14 of 2000?
Yeah, 2013-14.
Basically just last year.
Yeah.
That was probably our postseason classification on the fawns.
Yeah,
and I don't know if that was a statewide. We do it by units. There's about 30 units.
If you looked at my units on the last, on those years, I believe I was 76 was my survival rate, and that was both, I think probably 72 on fawns, 76 on does. That was my, and that's from the collar that I've been modeling with.
On the winter range where the deer didn't even use it this year, does that mean it's going to be in really good shape for the years to come,
no.
Or did we not get enough water to even help it?
I you know, it's too early to say, but if we get good spring rains, we might get some growth. But typically out in my area, if we don't have a good normal winter, we don't get the growth on the winter range. And so when they come back the following year, they're eating 2-year-old growth,
right,
which has got reduced amount of nutritional value. So it's a big difference.
Okay.
That's a really big difference for summer range limited versus winter range limited. Areas, I could, you know, if you don't get the good spring growth and good constant moisture through the summer, you can lose fawns. And then the following year, for the following season, winter, you can lose wind, you know, you could lose more winter range too.
Right.
So it's a double hit for West Desert Ranger.
We, Richard and I have been talking a little about the sage grouse stuff, you know, and the population problems that have been happening lately, and it's anecdotal, but we've noticed everywhere you find sage grouse, you also find crows. Wondered if the crows were hitting the legs, taking out the chicks.
Ravens more than crows.
Well, yeah, that's what I meant.
And we have worked with lodges, you got to differentiate between the two. I know we do now. And so we are working and looking at those kinds of things.
Okay.
And everybody I've talked to said just saw tons of chuckers. I guess they're out your way. I mean, are they just walking into them, or are population
up? They're on the swing. They're up. They're coming up. So we should start to see a good. We're probably a third of the way up from where they were 2 years ago. Last year was a good year. I expect to be gangbusters this year, unless we have some bad spring.
Yeah.
Spring rains at the wrong time, you know, but I expect a pretty good recovery. We're not at the peak, but we're getting.
Okay. You may have already mentioned this, I didn't quite catch it, but are you concerned about the deer staying on their summer range all winter and damage to the summer range?
I think they're more transitional ranges right now. Mm-hmm. And we've been there most of the winter. We've had some, there's snow up on top. And being at 8,000, 75 to 8,000 feet, I see that's more transitional. And they're basically eating winter range feed that's there, you know, on the side slopes, you know, the sagebrush and bitterbrush and stuff like that, woody vegetation. I don't see it as a big problem. This, you know, they had that diet change, and that's what they're going to be eating. And now they're kind of switching over. I've got a little bit of green up going on the south facing slopes, and they are coming down for that. So I don't think it's anything to worry about.
You've got a kind of a unique setup for dealing with nuisance deer in agricultural settings in Grantsville and now the one in Vernon. Let them know how you're using hunters, you know, and kind of a novel approach for dealing with those situations.
Well, the depredation rule, and I've kind of searched for different ways of dealing with this very thing, because a lot of my towns are agricultural, so I have depredation situations in city limits. And Grantsville approached it a couple years, about 4 years ago now. There's a rule in the depredation that allows landowners to create landowner association, and it's a little bit more confined, and it's in those special areas where a lot of depredation occurs. So, and it's only for antlerless. So we're not taking bucks out of the area. But so we formed both Grantsville and Vernon last year for the first time, created a landowners association, which allowed landowners to kind of pool their ground to allow hunters to actively remove with mitigation tags and vouchers, remove antlerless deer. And we've had some great success with that. Grantsville loves the program. And Grantsville is one of those special, I hate to say special, but it's one of those cities that allows hunting within city limits still, with archery, muzzleloader, and shotgun. Just up to last year, they used to allow rifles. But no centerfire cartridges now. So what some of the officers, the city mayor's involved in it, the police department's involved in it, and they've kind of adopted the approach to allow a lot of that to be youth hunts. And they guide them, a lot of the kids. They set them up on haystacks next to the fields, they put them in trees. I mean, they're trying to do whatever they can to harvest these deer. And they've reduced, I think he told me, they reduced their vehicle collisions by about half. You know, they still got quite a few deer in the city limits, but they've shown that they've reduced it, and it's helped the public. Vernon, for the first time did it last year. We were shooting for about 50 harvested, and I even have the data here. I can give you the actual numbers. I think we had 60-some-odd permits, and we killed 47 deer out of that. And I think it was widely accepted. The key to it is to get landowners that are cooperative to one another. I mean, headbutting and you know, neighbors that don't like each other, it tends to be selfish, and it doesn't work as well. But you know, with towns like Vernon, they're all kind of interrelated somehow. You know, and it really worked out pretty well. They have to allow hunters to go on their property as well as their hunters to go out on others. It's not the rule, but I stress it a lot when I talk to them, is that you need to call the neighbor that you're going on before you go. And that's just common courtesy. And if you do that, I think it goes a lot smoother, and it's worked pretty well. So that's kind of what we're working on out in the West as far as dealing with depredation around the ag fields and the cities there. I'm going to try to get it going for deer and antelope in Rush Valley this coming summer. They did a little bit with the antelope, but it kind of works a lot better with deer because they stay localized a little bit more than antelope do. So it's a neat program to work on. So any other questions?
I had one question on the moose. You know, we've had the declining moose populations. You alluded to the difference in productivity. It seemed like we noticed that we had a massive drop in moose numbers right shortly after we sold a bunch to neighboring states. Like we moved a bunch out of Paradise and Eden and those towns up in there, the ones that were causing problems. Does it have anything to do with that?
I seriously doubt it. Moose tend to be more densely affected with one another.
Okay.
And when you start seeing them getting kind of overcrowded, you see fewer calves, you don't see twins very often, those kinds of things. I doubt that the capture had anything to do with it or the reduction in the population. If anything, if they had moose to take out, then they were probably overpopulated.
Okay.
And it would have been more beneficial than harmful.
I know a lot of that mountain mahogany and stuff they eat is really highline.
They'd eat
that stuff takes a number of years to come back once they take it out. So that was part of the reason.
That's a habitat signal there that says you're getting polytenin.
Okay.
So I thought the data we saw earlier on the coyote bounty program indicated that your region was one that was most successful in the bounty.
Imagine that.
Yeah. But as you said, it's too early to have any data to say, is it having any useful effects?
Well, we're just getting into to what is actually killing deer. With the new collars, we're able to go right in to the actual GPS spot, and if we get there within the day, we can usually tell what killed it. With the other system, all we're looking at is it's dead or alive. We don't know what killed it. And so we have a couple of years of that data, and give us a couple more years, you know, with the new GPS stuff, and we probably will have some more information on that particular.
So I was wondering whether there's been any move to try to perhaps apply the bounty in areas where there's more of a depredation problem than what you're seeing.
A depredation problem as far as
coyote
on deer?
On deer.
My big movement is with the guys that are hunting out my area. They're hunting a lot of the coyotes that are in the valley bottom. And if you look at those locations that get turned in, I bet you'll see most of those are right along the lower benches and down in the valley. There's still coyotes up on the mountain at 8,000 feet all through the winter. And you know that as well as I do if you've been snowmobiling and seen. And the guys that are most successful that I know personally, that they ask me where to go, I send them up on the canyon, up on the mountain, and they're killing dogs. And those are the dumb ones, because they're not got everybody around with calls driving around in a white-colored dog pickup. So my advice to anybody hunting coyotes is to get off the valley bottom, get up on the mountain. That's where you're going to do us some good.
Get out of everybody thinks the ones in the bottoms are the easy pickings.
Not anymore,
because they're too smart. They've been harassed long enough. So they're done with it. Now it's time to move up.
Easy money is gone. Now it's time to do a little bit of hiking, get up on the mountain,
But that can be easy too if you know what you're doing.
It's more successful for probably the times that you go if you know what you're doing. And I got a guy that he kind of ticked me off. He was a lousy shot at first, and then he went and got a new rifle and says, I'm bound and determined. He's killing 6 dogs a week just on a hike. And so,
because he's getting out away from the bottom.
He is hiking.
He's hiking and getting up a little bit where they haven't been pursued, and so he's getting them.
Yeah, he's getting them.
And those are the ones that are probably going to make more difference than the ones in the valley bottoms.
Those are working our fawning areas. Those are the ones that are working our sage grouse. Because at least in my area, we have a few lakes that are up on the mountain a little bit.
So you're saying it's self-correcting.
Yeah. And so the easy money's gone until the pups start coming out. And they're not the dogs that go up the mountain. They're probably the ones that are going to stay in the valley their whole life. The ones in the mountain are still up on the mountain, and they're the ones that we need to get. But I get up. I got some guys that are avid coyote hunters, and they see, oh, Tom, can you do anything to stop these guys from coming out? Every one of them's got a white Dodge pickup truck, and they just walk off and turn their commercial call on, and their dogs are just getting smart. They're way too smart. And I'd probably stay away from the commercial calls. I use my voice, and I'd do better if I had time to go call.
Can you demo your successful sound?
Go. Mine is more of it's kind of a cross between a rabbit and a fawn deer.
She's not barking them in and then...
No, I'm not barking.
Hey, Tim, one other thought on the coyote program. We have a three-tiered approach. There's bounties, there's us hiring wildlife services, the federal guys, and then we have a program where we're hunting, where we hire contract trappers and hunters. And so some of those areas, like Tom was mentioning, these higher areas or areas where wildlife service isn't working too much, we've got guys under contract for us that are out doing that type of work. So we're trying to fit that niche where it's harder to get them, wildlife service isn't going there, and we're working that. And that we're just really ramping that up. We don't even really have 2 years of practice. We kind of did that some last year, and then we'll do it again starting about right now. It starts for this year. And they hunt those heavily through the spring and summer when a lot of these other hunters don't want to do it because the pelts aren't worth anything. So it's a variety of ways.
All right. Any other questions you've asked to any of the division branches? Go ahead, Carl.
I hate to put the director on the spot. At the expo, you made some comments about mule deer and the herds and buck-to-doe ratios and all that. I've heard a lot of comments about that. Maybe if you could take just a minute and maybe echo some of those.
So they, all the biologists turn in their data to our Salt Lake office, and then they sort of model the population numbers. We count elk and model deer. And they've sort of done their modeling, if you will, or wrapping that up right now. And it looks like our trend, because last couple of years have been good, and then we, you know, had a good year here this past year, and it looks like we're going to be back to around that kind of the pre-92 die-off for those of you who've been around doing this for a while. So
We're pretty excited about that. And because of the few number of duck tags that we have versus what you had in 1989 or 90 when, you know, there, we were still selling 200,000 licenses, you know, the buck to doe ratio is quite a bit different than you would have seen any time in the 70s or 80s, any, just because, you know, our strategy now is to not harvest as many bucks. So you got to go back, talking to our big game coordinator, you know, you got to go back even in the 50s to see a ratio of bucks to does, not the total number of deer that we had then, but the ratios, you know, going back 50 or 60 years. So that's pretty encouraging.
Things are looking up then.
Cool. So we're excited about that.
John, I haven't seen any roadkill data for a long time. Is anybody tracking that? Or?
Oh, we have a real-time database that all of our, anyone who's picking up dead deer has an app that they plug that information in, and it's sent on you know, on, over the web. And so it's, you know, something that we're building conjunction with collaboration with UDOT, and that database is pretty impressive. You can go in on any roadway and see, you know, how many deer, pick any time period and how many deer have been hit and picked up.
So what are the trends like? Are we doing better in terms of reducing that kill?
It's interesting. You would think that in a year when we had a mild winter, I'll take Highway 89 in Sanpete County as an example, where Tom is showing the animals are up at 8,000 feet. Down there, they were down in the valley bottom because there was green up, and they were down by the highways. And we had just as much, if not more, killed in the last 6 months on 89 in Sanpete County than we have in years, you know. In fact, more than if we'd had a bad winter where they really don't have access to, you know, forage down low and have to get on steeper west, you know, west facing and south facing slopes to get their browse. So I don't know, it's a special problem down there that we're working on.
I guess there's a couple different ways it happens. One is you got the migratory deer that go across, and they go across regardless, and they get hit. Yeah. The other is, well, they have to come down, and that's weather related. And like in Tooele, I've picked up the fewest amount of deer I've ever, since I started out there 20 some odd years ago. Right. And it's just not the weather that pushed them down into the areas where the traffic is. But it's seasonal too, and that is green up. I have deer coming down pretty close to the roadways, but they're not getting hit just yet. So there's a couple of different things that kind of influence that. And you mentioned green up, but the migratory thing is another. Yeah. They migrate across those major highways regardless of whether the weather's there or not.
Are there any programs in place? I know we talked about this a few years ago about fencing and things like that to try to help alleviate those problems. But is there anything that's ongoing now?
Right now, and it's usually in conjunction with highway projects. And we've got an extension of the project up 189 in Provo Canyon that's going to be going from the turnoff to Wallsburg to, you know, just this side of Charleston, you know, and actually Rainbow Bay, I think, is where they're going. And they're right there at that big, what they call McAfee Hill. There's quite a bit of deer reclamation land that's managed as part of Deer Creek State Park that those animals cross 189 right by that old Snow's Marina, if you remember that.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And we've met with UDOT, and they've got their consultants, and we met with them on site. And there will be an underpass or an overpass, I'm not sure which, right there at that cut. In conjunction with big game fencing on both sides of the highway. So, but, you know, when we have a project and there are funds allocated for road work in areas that have a history of big game vehicle collisions, that's when we can jump in with UDOT and get it part of the project. A lot more difficult to do it on its own.
Yeah.
We've been pretty successful in getting almost all of the UDOT projects to include fencing and tunnel system, so.
Yep, we've got some work to do in Parley's Canyon still. They're getting in.
That one's supposed to be the next plan.
Getting on the on ramps and off ramps. They're getting on the within the right of way there, and we moved a cow and a calf moose out of there a few weeks ago. That had been in there for a while. You know, there's enough habitat between the east and westbound lanes, you know, in some of that area that, in fact, even deer, you know, but I suspect they're getting in there, either Lamb's Canyon or the turnoff to East Canyon. And
they've got the grates in now at Lamb's Canyon, but
they won't
put them in at East Canyon. So
I think those grates may be the spacing that allows a moose to just walk across.
Moose doesn't really care.
No. But we're working closely with UDOT where we can.
John, what about the Mountain Accord? I know the division's been working with them on some stuff, but what about the issues of deer and elk and moose movement and migration relative to the Accord? I was kind of disappointed that they hadn't really included any real visionary stuff to deal with some of that. In other words, you know, we keep hitting critters, and it doesn't seem to be much promotion of under and overpasses or that kind of thing.
And this is in the canyons?
Right.
On the Wasatch?
Yeah, right. Wasatch Mountain Accord. Right.
Yeah. Mark, have you been involved with that a little bit?
Matt's attending that, but he's only, it just kind of started, so yeah. I think he's gone to two or three meetings.
Well, the reason I say that is that we're almost, you know, we're getting pretty close to them finishing up their whole proposal, and it just didn't seem like there was a lot of involvement relative to wildlife of any kind, really. And certainly no public involvement, so.
I don't have a good answer for you. I know that as far as a priority, we're working in other areas more than we are in the Cottonwood Canyons.
Right. Okay.
You know, on a lot of the same issues, but we do have someone that is involved, and if there's an opportunity for us to provide some input that's meaningful to their outcome, we certainly will. I'll be honest with you. It hasn't, that planning process hasn't been a high priority, and that's why you haven't seen a whole lot from us.
I have any questions?
We've tried participating in that somewhat, but right there, I don't see much coming out of this.
Well, that's
my point. It's going to have an impact.
Yeah, that was my point.
Maybe if anything, it might help migration.
This one's kind of a weird one. I know, I just wanted the division's perspective on that acquiring more federal lands in state control, is that, you see that as a good thing for sportsmen, or do you see that as that land's getting sold off and no longer being available to the public?
And the mic is still turned back. On.
Come on. Speak your piece.
We work for the governor. We love it. So that's a good one for you all to talk about.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, John, I got a question for you. So Greg mentioned that the mule deer are really doing well. We had a chance to look at the satisfaction surveys from last fall to see how the public's responding.
We have had information, and you've got...
Do you want to get...
I mean, we can leave. Why don't you just leave one of those? Did you pass those out?
No, I haven't. I haven't xeroxed so many copies off yet.
Okay. I can get you a copy of that. You can check.
But if you had a specific unit, you're
interested. I mean, is it high level positive?
You know,
are you seeing an upward trend?
I'm assuming that it is going to be positive, higher. You know, we rate, they're rated from
1 to 5.
My guess is we'll be up above 3.
But depends on the unit.
Yeah.
Sure.
What kind
sure.
of species, if you're interested, I can show you.
Well, I was curious about deer just because. We're doing so well. We talked a lot about it in the committee, and I'm just curious if we saw positive results
on
from last fall.
On the general buck?
Yeah. More specifically that one.
General buck stuff. If I had an angle from it. It ranges now.
Got to rotate through the biologists here so we got some eyes.
From a 3.3 to a 4.3.
That's pretty
good.
And that's over all the hunts. That's archery to any weapon. That's the range.
Good.
And that's including you,
also. Thanks, everyone. Sorry if I talked too much, but I'll
get it. Thanks for the last question.
Last question.
Hey, I know this is not in our area, but is there any data from the Monroe Farm study available?
I don't have that, honestly. I haven't seen any data on it. I mean, we've been busy. There's a little. They were down there this last week trying to recapture the collared ones that they did in February. So
I had this couple of dogs that were running around my cabin down there that had antennas on their back.
I wish I could tell you that, but that's, I don't have that data.
14.
Anybody else got anything?
Well, Chair just went to the bathroom.
He just told me.
He's got all leave.
Who's the vice chair?
Hey, what's the line meet, Amanda? What's the next meeting?
April 8th.
I'll make a motion.
I
should make an announcement that our RAC meetings from here on out will take place at the Civic Center, with the exception of the one in September, which will be in Salt Lake, and that's the fishing one.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
The Civic Center. The Civic Center City Hall.
Not the library.
Sensing we're running out of a little energy, are there any questions you have for Mike Slater, who has aquatics, or Mark Farmer, who had the chaining program going there for you? So
I do have one question.
Okay.
Talking about aquatics, and I don't know what the status of it is, but I heard a rumor that there's been a proposal made about adding $10 to boat registration fees. I don't know what the status of that is or what the plan is to get that money back and what it's going to be used for specifically.
Yeah, I can talk to that a little bit. This is in relation to Deer Creek Reservoir, and with the, as John mentioned, the suspect rating that it's got right now.
I mentioned a couple things.
There's just a real need to keep whatever's there.
Uh-huh.
We don't want to take a chance of having anything leave Deer Creek Reservoir. And so the state parks are doing a lot to try and monitor that and educate the public. And another thing that will have to take place is we need to make sure we can clean all of the boats that are leaving there. A boat's going to leave Deer Creek Reservoir, and the next day they want to go to Jordanelle or Strawberry or wherever. We need to make sure those are cleaned. In order to help that, we need more decontamination units, little sprayers, or in this case, actually a more of a temporarily permanent type decontamination unit. If you've been to Lake Powell, you've seen them there. Something more like those. And so in an attempt to get funds to help with this program, with the AIS program in general, there's a proposal or a bill to tap on $10 for people that register their boats. This has been attempted years and years ago, or an idea that was thought about and talked a lot about, but for various reasons did not pass or didn't go through the legislative process. Other states, surrounding states, are using this. Idaho does it. And so essentially, if you have a boat, the It'll cost you another $10 to register that boat. That money will be earmarked in one way or another for AIS projects or programs or to fund the program in general.
So, you mentioned that they only found villagers, stuff like that in Deer Creek.
Mm-hmm.
What's the life cycle? How often? How soon would we expect to see reproductive adults?
Okay, these samples were taken last October, a few months ago. It has been confirmed, but all they found are villagers. These are the young guys. We haven't found any encrusted quagga mussel on anything anywhere. For them to be able to reproduce or to be able to survive that part of the life cycle, typically it doesn't take place in water under 50 degrees. Obviously it gets under 50 degrees. We still have hope that we will not see any adults in Deer Creek Reservoir. We'll be doing an awful lot of sampling this spring, starting here really pretty soon actually, as soon as that water starts to warm up. And when I say sampling, the ways that they'll be doing it, we'll be doing scuba diving, we'll be taking water samples. That's how we found it in October. They've got structures, anchors, if you will, artificial anchors that we'll be putting into Deer Creek Reservoir, monitoring those. Again, we're just trying to confirm or see if we've got any kind of adults the reservoir. We haven't found those yet.
It's possible that, you know, the DNA that they analyzed came from villagers that were dead. Okay, so you don't know if it's DNA is DNA, you know. There's no determination yet that we have anything, any living quagga mussel of any of the life cycles or life stages in the reservoir, and that's what they're going to, you know, be looking for.
Well, how would they have got there in the first place?
It's villagers.
How would they have gotten there?
Do they attach the boats even that?
In the water?
They would be attached, but it's in the water. So
just in the
if
water.
Somebody didn't drain their motor, if somebody
they're
didn't
microscopic.
Drain their boat, their ballast tanks, things like that, that's how they can get transported. So now that's the approach at Deer Creek Reservoir is, okay, it's suspect. We don't want any water leaving Deer Creek Reservoir. So we'll have technicians, we'll have employees, the state parks, et cetera, will be making sure that every boat is pulling the plug, they're dropping their motor, they're emptying the ballast tanks before they can leave Deer Creek Reservoir. So that's going to be kind of the protocol.
I've heard people talk about it, but I don't know if there's any validity behind it. Is there any concern about smaller crafts such as float tubes, kayaks, that sort of thing, also being a vessel to get those from water to water?
Yeah. The way the rule states, if it floats, it's a boat, basically. Now, are we as concerned about a float tube or a kayak?
Mm-hmm.
No. But they'll still have to go through the same process to make sure that they've cleaned or drained or however you want to do that.
Because the
problem
is
different kinds of vessels.
With a lot of water, so those float tubers, I mean, you can walk up, you can park on the side of the road, walk down to the water, get in, get out, do the same thing at the next lake down the road.
Yep. Technically speaking, they have to go through the same process, the same drying period before they launch that float tube at another body of water if it's left Deer Creek Reservoir. In an attempt, they're trying to concentrate all the use at the main boat ramp at Deer Creek Reservoir. Now the island, it will be opened eventually, but right now during the off season it is not. Charleston boat ramp is closed to the launching of any boats. That doesn't prohibit, again, a float tube or a kayak or anything like that.
There might be an outreach opportunity there, because I know a lot of people are confused on that aspect
really?
Of it.
Yeah. To make sure that they understand that we still need to go through the
Yeah, a lot
same
of people
process.
Have a float tube. Is that the same
that
as a boat?
Yeah.
That,
right. So, okay, I'll pass that on.
Ken, you have a question?
I just wonder, no matter what we find out, though, Deer Creek's going to be 3 years, right?
For the next 3 years, pretend there's quagga mussel in Deer Creek Reservoir. It doesn't matter whether it's suspect or whether we've confirmed that there's adults. The containment process or the protocol would be the same. We need to make sure that the boats are cleaned and drained before they leave that body of water. So.
All right.
Anything for Mark? There is, just kind of cut that off quickly. Give a little bit more time. Mark going once.
That's been exciting to us, guys.
Mark going twice.
Yeah, I'll ask him a question.
I'm not a very good auctioneer.
What projects have you, what major projects have you got planned this year?
We have about 31 projects in the region now for consideration. A lot of those are pinyon and juniper manipulation projects for sage-grouse. A lot of BLM and on BLM lands, mostly concentrated in the Vernon area. A lot of scatter projects for hand cutting. So that's the bulk of it. And I don't think we'll have to fight for the funding with the rest of the state, but hopefully we get about 20 or so of those funded. There's a lot of big ticket, big money projects throughout the state that we'll be fighting for funding. But that's what the bulk of our projects are.
Do you have an estimation of how many acres you want to treat this year?
Typically it's somewhere around 12,000, upwards of 15, depending on how many fires burn. That's typical. So, but statewide, we're treating over 100,000 acres, which is pretty amazing.
Bruce, with law enforcement, do you have any breaking news stories that we want to lay on the group here, or any questions for Bruce?
Right now we have, like John was saying, we've got cases in the legal system right now. We're waiting to finish up. The last couple of years have produced a lot of big game, high profile cases that we're finishing up there. Either suspension hearings right now. We're going to be really busy the next few months with suspension hearings from the last couple of years building up. Next week, we start our hiring process again, our testing and interviews. We're looking to hire 4 new officers statewide. We don't know where they'll end up yet. That'll kind of prove out over the next few months with transfers and such.
And the number of candidates for those 4 jobs?
Right now, we've got 60 plus candidates that we're looking at.
Takes a while.
That process.
It's a huge process.
I'd just like to say something. There by the Steel Ranch property.
Yes. Right?
We had a problem there the other day, but I'll talk about it. But that place is starting to look like a garbage ground. I hadn't been there for a long time. We went out there. The people are going out there and setting up targets. They're leaving their brass, they're leaving everything there. Beer cans, I mean, it's turning into a garbage dump. And I kind of would hope that somehow they would, I don't know if they're going to police it or if you're just somehow going to shut that down a little bit, because it's a mess. And we actually were trying to drive down the road. We had a guy shoot across the road in front of us 10 feet.
Yeah, I heard about that.
That was kind of scary.
And we were actually just talking with Mark a little bit about that and trying to develop a new spot and get them situated in one or two locations where we don't
They need to be shooting towards the mountain, not out over across the
field. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah,
crazy.
We're looking to try and
I'm not sure how to change their habits, because they want to shoot long distance. Yeah. I don't know if they'll stop if we make a new place. And I'm kind of hesitant to make a nice shooting range for him, because
it's not
kind of shooting range.
I don't think I would.
No.
So I don't think you want to turn it into.
So we clean it up a couple times a year. It's been worse in the past as far as you get on the road where the little gravel pit area is. That's been pretty trashy in the past. It's pretty nice now, but there's a lot of people that use that every weekend. Sometimes it gets worse. So I don't think about how to do it, how to address that problem.
Lawyers here, we can wrap up.
Well, there is one item. I was talking with Greg. There were 3 rules that related to to the prairie dog plan. I mean, there were 3 rules that needed one that needed to be created, and 2 that needed to be amended. And so we took action on the first one. If you would take a motion, everything that was identified in the plan is consistent with the amendments that are being recommended in the rule that were in your packet. So if you just want to make a blanket motion, you know, regarding that, then we've addressed everything on the list that we needed to tonight.
Okay. There are the two. One was the collection, importation, transportation, and possession. You mentioned some minor changes in that. The other was the taking of non-game animals. That was the one I tongue-in-cheek referred to, because it has aardvarks and great apes and some of the other animals on there that I've not noticed in Utah. Anyway, we need to act on these, because we need to report to the board and give them our disposition. And those guys, I know you had a chance to read through the packet and look at that. And they are minor changes from the old ones. You can see it in where the lines are through it and the changes. They're just mostly wording changes. I can entertain a motion on accepting that and moving forward with it.
So this time I do the motion to accept the rule as written.
Okay. Both, you have a second on that?
19 and 3.
Yeah. Yeah, both of them. Do you need the numbers? Do you have them?
19 and 3.
Okay. We have a motion.
Seconded.
Seconded by Richard. All in favor? Passed unanimously.
I guess we're adjourned, but now that we're adjourned,
yes,
we need to say thanks to Jay Price for... Come on up, Jay. In the way that we like to, leave you with a Clark Bronson print of your choice. Thank you very much for probably nine years, because we started out as the ag rep, and then when he decided to be a Wasatch County Councilman, we shifted him over to elected official. I don't know, you can hang around and be non-consumptive, or, you know.
I'm a consumptive guy.
But thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
All right, meeting's adjourned.